Good morning, everyone. My name is Kylie Hogan, and I'm going to be the chair for the concurrent session today, which is Judgment Day, Insights into the Impacts of Legal Judgments on CTP. Presenting today is Danny Rule and Emily Wooden. Danny is a director in EY's General Insurance Actuarial Practice, bringing 18 years of experience in the general insurance industry. Emily is the Manager of Regulatory Policy within the State Insurance Regulatory Authority, or CIRA. Emily has acquired substantial expertise in law and public policy, particularly in the New South Wales personal injury schemes. The session will go for about half an hour with 10 minutes of Q&A at the end. As I'm sure everyone's aware by now, you can ask a question two ways, either in person at the microphone just there, and I have a roaming one here as well, or on the IDSS app, which hopefully you have, but you can use the QR code to download if not. And now I invite Danny and Emily to kick things off. Thanks.
All right, I'm going to have to give this a whirl without my notes. So I hope that people will take pity on me whilst we're going through this. So I'm going to start off by going through some of the overview of how CIRA manages and monitors significant legal matters, and then Danny will talk to some of those considerations that we take into account when looking at those matters. So I'm sure many of you have been involved over the years in some pretty tricky litigation or disputes. These arise particularly in our schemes around particular statutory benefits or eligibility or lump sum damages claims. Where the eligibility for these benefits depends on a number of threshold tests. When these disputes emerge and decision makers, either at tribunals or through the courts, are asked to interpret governing legislation, the outcome can change the way in which the scheme operates. Litigation can also result in clarifying interpretive issues. However, depending on the nature of the change that can result from decisions, this can also lead to significant scheme costs, operational complexities, and unintended scheme design. What we have noticed is that as the scheme has developed and as stakeholders have become really familiar with our legislation, that we are seeing more testing and more novel disputes emerging as that's considered by the courts. So what I'll first work through is how CIRA monitors these disputes. So we do that in a number of different ways. Importantly, under our insurer's licence conditions, they're required to report significant matters under our significant matters policy. So this policy covers a range of potential matters. It includes privacy, fraud, regulatory breaches, things like that. But we do have a very specific section that outlines what kind of legal matters would fall into that policy. So that would be things that might have a novel nature. They might be on appeal to the High Court or other courts. They may have a significant impact on the number of compensable matters or the compensation that's associated with certain matters. There's quite a long list, and it's a published policy on our website that goes through which of those legal matters we would like to know about and be aware of. We also regularly consult with our other government's partners and stakeholders, make sure that we're aware of anything that's happening across the scheme. And we also have a significant monthly litigation reporting that makes sure that we are really across what's happening, what matters are being determined, and maybe things that we need to be aware of. So when we do have a matter that comes up, we then need to consider how can we respond to those matters. Oftentimes it's generally inappropriate for us to, or we wouldn't necessarily seek to make changes whilst a matter is being heard. We wouldn't necessarily engage in that process to avoid any perceptions or actual interference as the process proceeds through the courts. And we would have to consider any risks that are associated with matters before the courts. So I'm going to move across to our first matter here. So this is the matter of Abawi. So in this matter, my notes still have not fixed themselves. So in this matter, the injured person unfortunately received injuries to their wrists. They received scarring injuries to their wrists. What the court was asked to consider was whether those injuries to the skin are a soft tissue injury and therefore a threshold injury within within Section 1.6 of the Motor Accidents Injuries Act. So in first instance, they determined that it was a non-threshold injury. So that would mean that those scarring to the wrists would not be included in this definition of a soft tissue injury. So this definition basically outlines that a soft tissue injury is an injury to tissue that connects, supports, or surrounds other structures or organs of the body, such as muscles, tendons, ligaments, menisci, cartilage, fascia, fibrous tissue, fat, blood cells, and synovial membranes, but not an injury to nerves or a complete or partial rupture of tendons, ligaments, menisci, or cartilage. This is quite a different approach than had been previously taken under the scheme. So up until this point, the scheme had essentially had a fairly pragmatic approach to these injuries, looking at the nature of the injury themselves, but it had been something that was, under dispute within the scheme and that had been considered by a number of different decision makers. I'm going to leave this here now and I'll go to our next matter, and then Danny will come up and speak to some of the considerations that we had when we were looking at a response to these matters as they were being heard, and then I will come back to the decisions that were made on appeal. So the second matter that we have recently had in New South Wales was the matter of McTighe and Chang. So this is quite an interesting one. This one is around whether a state-operated bus accident is a motor vehicle crash or a public transport accident. So as many of you would know, we previously transitioned from the 1999 scheme to the 2017 scheme. So we also have this third act, which is the Transport Administration Act. This deals with public transport. It's under the remit of our Minister for Transport. And there is a section in there, which is 121, which basically outlines that where somebody is injured in a public transport accident, those injuries should be determined in accordance with Chapter 5 of the 1999 Act. The issue that came up here was that somebody was injured in an accident involving an STA bus. And so the decision at hand then, or the decision that had to be made at that point was, is this STA bus a public transport accident or a motor vehicle accident? And in which case would it be determined in accordance to the 1999 Act or the 2017 Act? I'll just give a bit of background as to why Section 121 is here. So Section 121 basically establishes a process by which somebody can have their injuries assessed or compensation assessed if they are injured in a public transport accident, including things like ferries, trains, etc. So I'm going to hand over to Danny now and then I'll come back and speak to you about where both of those cases ended up.
Thank you, Emily. So this slide goes through a little bit of a high-level view on what approach we would take to do a bit of a costing for these matters. And as most of the actuaries in the room would know, it's fairly common and it's a typical sort of process you would go through. But there are a few nuances that I will go into to reflect on the fact that these cases are niche. They're edge cases that are being tested in the scheme, and so there's other considerations that you would need to apply when doing this costing. The very first is to really understand what is being disputed. I'm an actuary, I'm not a lawyer, so I need the help of people like Emily, Sarah, lawyers, insurers, to really give information. What is the dispute here? What is the one party arguing? What is the other party arguing? What are the likely decisions and outcomes that could be made? And the reason that's really important is because that informs the sort of analysis that you need to do, some of the assumptions that you need to make, and also helps us to connect the dots around where we think this would impact the scheme. Is it likely to result in more claims? Is it likely to result in claims transitioning from one type to another, which is what is the case for a Bowie? And is there likely to be additional cost? So that's really an important step before you even jump into the data is, well, what actually is being disputed? In some cases like McTighe, it's really complex. It's got multiple acts that are interacting that are resulting in an outcome that For us as actuaries, it's sort of a bit unusual because it's allowing someone to claim under the 99 scheme, which is technically in runoff. So we don't expect any more claims. But all of a sudden, we've got a situation where an accident that's occurring today is still could receive benefits under the 99 Act. So the first step is understanding what is being disputed. The second one is around the data quality and availability. Now, as I said, these are often edge cases, and in most cases, the data is collected, but it might not provide you with all the information you need to really understand how this the outcome of this legal matter might play out. So there's challenges around the data, how much of it you've got, and the reliability and volatility in the experience. And that often will drive your model development and assumptions. So in these cases, our models were actually quite simple. So they're frequency average claim size models. We'd love to do something more complex, but the quality and the accuracy of doing that is probably not going to be there. And there's a lot of assumptions and uncertainties, which I'll go through for each of the cases. The other really important one is in CTP and workers' comp, where you're dealing with people and multiple stakeholders. Often you've got to think about what is the direct impact of a change or a decision, but often there's a lot of indirect or behavioural impacts. So how are the insurers going to change their behaviour? How is the injured person going to change their behaviour? How is the lawyer going to change their behaviour to respond to whatever the outcome is of this decision? And that's really important because those are the things that might not appear from a cost perspective on day one, but over time you're likely to see those behaviours driving differences in claim frequency and the cost of claims. The other aspect is prospective versus retrospective. So we were providing a costing or advice on both of those. These decisions would have an impact on future premiums, or potentially could have an impact on future premiums, but could also open up retrospective impacts. So previous claims that may still be open or have closed may then reopen and be disputed, and it may achieve additional costs, which would impact the historical profitability of those accident years. So there's two aspects that need to be considered here. Our results and ranges, I put that in because, well, often we're looking at different scenarios, and we're looking within each scenario, what is the range of outcomes that could occur? Given the large uncertainty here and the fact that the data quality or the availability of data is low, there's often quite wide ranges that are also driven by the behavioural effects that may or may not emerge. And then finally, we look at, obviously looking at ongoing monitoring and response. What is actually happening once the decision's been made? So for Abawi, some of the sort of key issues this has got to do with skin injuries. And really what was important for us initially was to look at the injury codes. Now, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of injury codes. And the sort of key challenge for us was to determine which of those injury codes really reflected the skin injuries that are being challenged here. So there needed to be some sort of criteria. We developed our own criteria. We tested it with CIRA. We tested it with a couple of insurers. I think one of the insurers provided their own view on what codes would fit where, which was really useful in helping us work out the sort of claims that would be impacted by this decision. There's also a question of uncoded injuries or missing injuries. Because we're talking about skin injuries, often there are more significant soft tissue injuries that might have been coded. And so there was always a risk that maybe what we're looking at doesn't include the skin injuries, but the skin injuries were there. So it just hasn't been coded. So there was that risk that we might underestimate the number of claims that actually could be captured by this decision. If we go into the key uncertainties, so some of the things were not clear to us in terms of the costing was the relevance of the severity of the skin injury. So what if the skin injury is superficial? So Emily mentioned sort of scarring to the wrists. What if it's really superficial injury to the skin? Is that still going to be captured in this decision and mean that that claim, however minor the scratch or the laceration to the skin is, would still be treated or would be able to be transitioned or assessed as non-threshold, which is actually quite a significant impact if that's the way it was interpreted. I've mentioned the missing injuries or the potential for some codes to just not be coded because they might have been really trivial. and then the actual behaviour of the different parties. So what are insurers likely to do? Are they likely to continue to sort of assess these claims as threshold claims and then wait for that person to dispute or request an internal review, which would then potentially transition them into non-threshold? Or once this decision was made, if it went the way of skin is an organ and therefore it's not soft tissue, so therefore it's non-threshold, would they just go, okay, let's just start to assess everything as non-threshold? So there's a key behaviour question there. And similarly around lawyers and the injured person themselves. Once there's awareness of this potential pathway, how would their behaviour change? In addition to the frequency, the key bit is, well, what is the additional cost once a claim transitions from threshold to non-threshold? And that's really the key bit that our modelling focused on. If I look at some of the sort of high-level assumptions we made, we decided to take a wider list of codes than a narrower one to ensure that we were capturing more of the claims and reduce the risk of us underestimating that. It turns out that about 30% of threshold claims had a skin injury coded, so that kind of provided us with a little bit of a lower bound into where that would go. We assumed that the severity of the injury was irrelevant, so it doesn't matter how superficial the skin injury is, it would still be captured. We assumed that insurers would start to assess them as non-threshold rather than wait for a dispute or an internal review to occur. And we did make the assumption, this is quite an important one, that there would be no behavioural change from injured people, although we allowed for that in some of the ranges that we provided. Our modelling approach, as I said, was a fairly simple frequency average claim size. The frequency part of it relied heavily on the injury code listing. And for the average claim size, we took four approaches and we sort of looked at it in four different ways. And really what we were trying to do was look at a segmentation analysis, which looked at ways of grouping claims, similar claims together that were really on the boundary of threshold and non-threshold. And the way we decided to do that was to segment all claims by severity from 1, 2 and 3 plus, and 3 plus being the most severe, and then looked at it in four ways, which was how many injuries does this person have? And we segmented it by a number of injuries. Another segmentation approach was what is the primary injury or the category of injuries that they have? The other two was looking really about benefits, how much benefits have been paid within the first 6 months, because the first 6 months is common to both threshold and non-threshold. And so we looked at, well, how much treatment and care was being provided. And if there was similar treatment and care provided within the first 6 months, we used that as an indicator of potentially the ultimate cost also being quite similar. And we did the same with loss of income. So we used four approaches and we used a weighted approach to come up with a bit of a central estimate. So these are some of the results for Abawi. It's more material. The cost here was more significant, mainly driven by the number of claims. As you can see, it's about 2,000, close to 2,000 claims that we could see which would be captured in this potential decision. And when you look at the costs are quite substantial as well. So the colours represent the main benefit types. You can see loss of income and treatment and care is close to 20,000 on average. And then the common law component is really the substantial component, which had the bigger uncertainty around it. But we could see potentially common law being on average $20,000 to $30,000 to $40,000. So it was quite substantial. And really the driver of that wasn't so much the skin injury. So the skin injury itself could potentially be the cause for the transition, but really it was all the other soft tissue injuries that might have been more significant that would then drive the cost. And that was our view on the prospective. In terms of retrospective, what we did was to look at, well, how many claims are still open? And as you can see, for the very sort of older accident years, there's not many of these claims open. Most of these were entitled to 26 weeks of benefit, and by the time we got to looking at this in 2025, most of those claims had closed. But we looked at the ones that were still open, we looked at those that were still legally represented, and our view was that they would be the first ones that would potentially be impacted by this decision. So the lawyers would be aware of this decision. They would go through their files, find the ones that are still open and still being able to be managed, and then would lodge a dispute and push them through the system to get the decision to be changed. And as you can see, the numbers at the bottom row look small, but they're actually quite material given the additional costs that could arise. So the retrospective cost was also quite a substantial impact. So that's Abawi. If we look at Mactai and Chang, similar sort of issues. The data is much more limited because we're talking about public transport accidents and buses. We're mainly talking about Class 6C. There's about 90 claims across the scheme per year in that sort of cohort. So it's quite small. The experience is volatile. We needed longer-term experience to look at this because of the sort of volatility in the experience, which meant that we needed to rely on the 99 scheme, which had its own sort of challenges. The key uncertainties were this matter was much more legally complex, so we needed to really understand how this decision could play out. As I said, we're dealing with smaller number of claims. Reliance on the 99 scheme, we know the scheme changed quite a bit, so there's a question about whether it's relevant to still use the 99 scheme experience for the 2017 scheme. And the key issue here again was really by being able to claim under the 99 scheme, you've got access to damages, and the damages could be substantially different and more significant than they would be under the 2017 scheme. The other unique issue here is uncertainty from us around whether people could double dip. So if you've already received benefits under the 2017 scheme, are you then able to get some additional benefit from the 99 scheme, or would there be a netting off and no sort of double dipping? So that was another sort of potential for additional cost to come through. Going through our assumptions, the assumptions we made was public transport buses, we focused on Class 6C. We made the assumption that injured people cannot elect which scheme to claim under. Once a decision was made, then that would then be clear on which one it was. There'd be no double dipping, and the claim frequency we assumed would be the same. We didn't see why there would be more or less bus accidents between the two schemes. Our modelling approach, again, was quite simple, the frequency times average claim size. I've got the wrong thing there for frequency. Frequency, we didn't use the injury code list. The frequency, we looked at the 99 scheme and had a view on what was the long-term frequency for claims in the 99 scheme and used that for the 2017 scheme. And then we compared the schemes for the average claim size. Interestingly, and it was sort of a bit of a coincidence, we actually used some of the analysis from Abawi to help us with this one. And the reason for that is because this also involved, in a different way, the same sort of claim, being able to claim for damages when under the 17 scheme they're not because they're a threshold claim, but under the 99 scheme that concept doesn't exist and it would open up an ability to claim under common law. So we were actually able to use some of the analysis from Abawi to help us with this one. So what did the results look like? So the results of Chang are less material from a scheme perspective compared to Abawi because the number of claims is significantly lower. So as I said, it's about 100 or 90 to 100 claims per year. So we assumed that wouldn't change. The costs themselves, when we looked at the average claim size, this is for what, non-threshold, we actually didn't see there being much difference between the 17 scheme and the 99 scheme, noting that the 17 scheme was still relatively young and undeveloped, but we could see that the average was sitting at a similar sort of level. So that really sort of focused our attention on the people who would be classified as threshold under the 17 scheme. They're the ones that are most likely to be able to access bigger lump sum damages settlements if they're able to claim under the 99 scheme. And so that was the key component of our cost impact. So overall, the cost to the scheme wasn't as material as Abawi, but for the premium for Class C, it would be quite a relatively big change. And the other component that's sort of non-financial was around the operational impact for insurers. So we recognised that insurers would need to maintain some ongoing capability to manage claims under the 99 scheme if that's the way the decision played out. I'll just pass to Emily.
So I'll now go through the outcomes of both of those cases on appeal. So one of the other main reasons that we wait for litigation to finalise before progressing any response in most cases is that we need to see the outcome. We need to see the technical outcome, what is actually being decided and the actual issues that might emerge from that decision. So I'll just go summarise back again what the issue with Abawi. So whether those lacerations to the skin on both wrist injuries that were sustained were threshold injuries within the meaning of Section 1.6 of the Motor Accident Injuries Act. So when the court then considered this on appeal, they were considering whether skin is tissue that connects, supports or surrounds other structures or organs of the body while also being an organ itself. So that's that definition around soft tissue. The outcome was that the New South Wales Court of Appeal agreed that the word other qualifies that language around structures and organs. They considered that soft tissue was intended to be a subcategory of all tissue, with the differentiation being that the tissue, soft tissue, was performing a certain function, that function being to connect, support and surround those other structures or organs. So whilst most organs would be excluded from the definition of soft tissue, they would be excluded not because they are organs, but rather because they don't have this function of connecting, supporting or surrounding. So as such, they did determine that injuries to the skin were soft tissue injuries. So as you can imagine, that was a good outcome from the scheme. It did reinstate the way the scheme had approached skin injuries in the past and allowed a level of certainty around that definition. So when we now look at our response to the decision itself, it's to actively review the application of that decision to other matters within the scheme and consider its use. Now, when we turn to Chang, when this matter went on appeal, the court again considered the construction of Section 121 of the TAA. So again, this was technical construction. I will mention that in Abawi, there were submissions lodged around extrinsic material. The court did determine that it was primarily a statutory interpretation issue, and that material wasn't didn't come into the eventual decision. So with the decision around Chang, the court determined that there was two discrete categories of accident. So as we noted, a public transport accident under the TAA and a motor vehicle accident under the Motor Accidents Injuries Act. So they then needed to determine under which act the STA bus accident fell. So in subsection 1 of 121 of the TAA, it states that Chapter 5 of the MACA would apply to a public transport accident unless it was an award of damages to which the chapter applies. So as Chapter 5 of the MACA does not apply to accidents occurring under the 2017 scheme, for obvious reasons, it means that they that the Section 121 of the TAA would apply to those STA public buses and they would be a public transport accident rather than a motor vehicle accident for the purposes of determining damages. So as opposed to Abawi, this case did create a pretty significant change in the way in which those claims for that cohort operated. The decision introduced a level of uncertainty and created practical, operational, and legal challenges for stakeholders. So it was determined that a response to that decision was appropriate. So as such, CIRA is working with the Department of Transport and is currently consulting on ways in which to address that ambiguity that's emerged. So just a summary, the way in which we are continuing to review matters and continuing to consult on significant legal matters is through that ongoing monitoring process that I discussed above at the start of the presentation. Ongoing stakeholder engagement and really utilising our response and assessment frameworks that we have published on our website. So the significant matters policy that is there and also our intervention policy. That's everything. Thank you.
Thank you both. That was really great. There are no questions yet. Did anyone have any ones that they wanted to ask? No, Jeff, do you want this one?
Thanks, guys. Emily, I think of these, like, Supreme Court decisions, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. You know, something will come up and as responsible for the scheme, into whack-a-mole. But a different question about the Personal Injuries Commission, the PIC, which is arguably rather more significant overall to the schemes that you're regulating. Do you have any way of, or do you deal with the PIC at a kind of systemic level as opposed to whack-a-mole on individual decisions?
So we do obviously monitor decisions that are going through the commission. Certain decisions within the commission, you do see that they the reasoning behind them can sometimes be adopted across decision makers. The decisions themselves don't have precedent value in the same way that, like, obviously a court decision does. So whilst we look at those decisions for thematic purposes, it's probably more along those lines to start to understand any issues or complexities that might be arising in the scheme or novel concerns. I hope that answers that question in the way they...
Kind of. Personally, I hate judicial review of those decisions, the whole idea of it. And somewhere I'd like to see in the overall system more ability to apply scheme philosophies, scheme principles to that, including putting an obligation on the PIC to consider that. Easier said than done, and it's difficult legal stuff, but
please do.
We do see the objects of the Act being considered as part of decisions and in their like holistic approach. With Abawi, I did note that there was extrinsic material that was considered as part of that decision. At the time, the court determined that that wasn't, given the statutory interpretation nature of the dispute, it wasn't existing.
Were there any more questions? Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Emily and Danny. Regarding the Chan decision, I'm just wondering, the impact of the court decision would just affect the class, Starbus class, or would that expose more accidents to the 1999 Act?
So the court was fairly specific that it did only apply to the SDA buses. So they spent quite a bit of time discussing the nature of Section 121, which is around whether or not the government should benefit from essentially a restriction on damages disputes. So they were fairly specific that it only applies to STA-operated buses rather than other bus types.
Sorry, just to clarify, you said other bus types, but there's Class 21 as well, which is the light rail, which is a public transport. Was that excluded or not considered?
Not considered.
Was there anyone else? Any more questions? No. All right, everyone, join me in thanking Danny and Emily. Thank you very much.